Hi, from the Bear Cave, I'm Barry Slater. We'll turn first to the editorial and opinion pages of the Wednesday, July 10th, USA Today. Our first op-ed is written by Chris Brennan. It's titled, Republicans Give Trump a Pass on Accountability. Biden Needs That from Democrats. The dueling campaign emails that landed in my inbox back-to-back Monday afternoon capture the whipsaw essence of this ridiculous race. Joe Biden is dropping out of the race, the email from former President Donald Trump's campaign declared, saying, you know it, I know it, everybody knows it, it can happen at any moment. President Joe Biden's campaign offered this counter-declaration from him in an email 9 minutes later. Let me be clear, I'm running. I'm the Democratic Party's nominee. No one is pushing me out. I'm not leaving. Both asked for donations that they said they need to beat the other guy. But Biden is also asking for something else from his supporters, the kind of pass Republicans give Trump in his troubled bid for a second term. That's a tall order. I'm not so sure Biden catches that kind of a break from Democrats seriously freaked out by his disastrous debate performance, followed by days of limited scripted appearances and then a 22-minute ABC News interview that did nothing to reset his campaign. There's a reason for that, which probably seems unfair to many Democrats hoping Biden stays in the race. The Democratic Party these days holds its candidates far more accountable than the Republican Party does. Sorry, but politics has never been an endeavor rooted in a foundation of fair play. You know who can change that approach to candidates? Democrats. They're the only people with the power to give Biden the sort of pass that Republicans give Trump. An immensely popular candidate who, in the past year, has become a convicted felon, was held liable in a civil case for sexual assault, and faces fines of $454 million for running a business rife with fraud. But here's the catch. A crucial Democratic argument for giving Biden a second term plays into the understandable trepidation that a second Trump term invokes. Biden has been previously cast as competent and stable, the opposite of Trump's autocratic irascibility. But if Democrats treat Biden the way Republicans treat Trump, looking past the president's very evident physical and mental issues, then drawing distinctions between the two candidates goes all fuzzy. There's nothing new about this. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton tried to keep quiet about the pneumonia she was suffering from in September 2016 while battling Trump for the White House. That went sideways when she was spotted nearly collapsing in public. Clinton took all kinds of heat as Trump reveled in her brief medical crisis, claiming she lacked the stamina to be president and required naps on the campaign trail. His supporters ate that up. Did they care 8 years later when Trump had a hard time keeping his eyes open through his own criminal trial? Of course they did not. The closest Trump ever came to accountability was in October of 2016 when the infamous Access Hollywood videotape leaked and voters heard the would-be president boasting about getting away with groping women. Some Republicans briefly suggested that Trump should drop his bid for the presidency. He flatly refused. Sound familiar? And why? Because Trump had already correctly claimed that there was a significant portion of the Republican Party that would never dare to hold him accountable for anything. Consider one of Trump's most memorable boasts in the 2016 election. I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, Trump told supporters in Iowa that January. Trump isn't just forgiven for demolishing norms and standards in American politics. A big chunk of his supporters celebrate it. This very vocal minority of Americans revel in Trump's distaste for civility and disregard for anyone in pursuit of his ambition. Trump showed up for the first debate in 2020 in the middle of a pandemic after a positive COVID-19 test, but did not share that publicly. While hospitalized for COVID-19 treatment, Trump forced Secret Service agents to pile into the presidential limousine so they could drive around the block, letting him wave to assembled supporters. On January 6, 2021, Trump sat sullenly in the White House watching his supporters attack police officers during the riot at the U.S. Capitol. He spent hours shrugging off pleas from allies to intervene and stem the chaos. Ask Trump supporters about all that, and they'll flip the accountability on anyone but Trump. They'll pivot to complain about efforts to contain the coronavirus and suggest the Capitol riot was some sort of a setup. And Democrats? Members of the U.S. House and Senate spent this week arguing in private and staking out positions in public. They all want to defeat Trump. Not all of them think Biden is up to that. Biden has rejected calls to step aside, and Vice President Kamala Harris has shown no inkling or political leverage to push him off the ticket. The Democrats don't want a convention fight in Chicago next month, so they're stuck with Biden unless he upstages his debate debacle with another public calamity. Biden has nearly 40 days until the Democratic Party makes the presidential nomination official and nearly 4 months until November's election. In a normal election year, that would look like plenty of time to right the ship. Nothing about this election year is normal. The presumptive Republican nominee is a criminal campaigning on a promise of retribution. The presumptive Democratic nominee is an incumbent fighting some in his own party for political survival. Now we wait to see if Democrats can move like Republicans here. If Biden makes it to the convention and then to November's ballot, Democrats might have to load the gun, take him to Fifth Avenue, choose a target, and hope his aim is true. Next, from the Wednesday, July 10th USA Today, an op-ed written by Sarah Pequeno. His title, Biden Seems Committed to Staying in the Race. I wish he would commit to convincing us. When I was a child, I assumed that the majority of adults knew what to do in a moment of crisis. It seemed like the adults in my life, at home, school, and church, knew what to do when faced with panic. I certainly thought elected officials and the people who work for them would be so competent. After nearly 2 weeks of Democratic feet dragging about the president, I'm starting to have doubts about that. We are in the second week of headlines about President Joe Biden's disastrous debate performance, and it seems like no one can discern what to do at this consequential moment in U.S. politics. The Democratic Party is acting as though this conversation can drag on. Party leaders must be forgetting how close the election is and that Election Day is right around the corner. 5 Democrats in the House of Representatives have called on Biden to drop out of the presidential race, but a lot more have rallied behind him, including the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. While Biden seems ready to move on, the conversation is far from over. And while he has insisted that he is staying in the race, his campaign officials must know they still have work to do. One of the more surprising endorsements of Biden post-debate came from New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or AOC, a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The matter is closed, Ocasio-Cortez told reporters Monday on Capitol Hill. This declaration from one of the most outwardly progressive lawmakers leads me to believe there is nothing left to discuss. Biden will be the Democratic nominee, and there's nothing we can do about it, even if it feels like a potential disaster. If that is the case, the rest of the party needs to fall in line, including the progressives who have voiced their concerns. That's what the Republicans do, and it's exactly why the same questions are not being asked about former President Donald Trump. While the 78-year-old Trump is nearly as old and has had slip-ups, the 81-year-old Biden is the president. It means Republicans are able to sit back and relax and watch the mess unfold, even though their presumptive nominee is the one who should be under such a high level of scrutiny. All of the conversation about Biden's age has overshadowed the glaring issues with Trump. The 34 felony counts and 54 charges against him, the sexual abuse, and his catastrophic track record as president have been sidelined as Biden's potential incompetence has become a larger issue. Meanwhile, Trump is only 3 years younger than Biden. In February, 59% of respondents in an ABC News Ipsos poll said they believed both candidates were too old for a second term. In a more recent Wall Street Journal poll, 76% of Democratic voters say Biden is too old to run. 36% of Republicans voters say the same about Trump. While Biden fell short during the debate, Trump should not be ignored. The Democratic Party needs to remember that beating him is still the main objective. If Biden's age is such an issue, why not point out the same issues with Trump? Democrats aren't helping themselves by continuing to make noise around Biden if he has decided to keep running. For months, I've observed the growing discontent among young voters with the Biden administration, particularly over the funding of Israel amid its attacks on Gaza. Hopefully, that reality will not be lost on members of the Democratic Party. As frustrating as it is to see the writing on the wall, it's more frustrating to see the party collapse instead of taking a firm stand with Biden or offering to hold new primary elections ahead of the Democratic National Convention. The Democrats need to earn our trust, especially after Biden's debate. They aren't going to do that by ignoring our criticisms of the president. They need to show us that Biden is capable of speaking in public. That's the minimum. At best, they can show us that Biden is capable and willing to listen to us. Biden has made the case to Democratic governors and donors as to why he should stay in the race. He attempted to convince the American public in his Friday interview with ABC News and with a phone call to MSNBC's Morning Joe, but it's clear that it will take more than a few interviews to calm anxieties about Biden's age and cognitive ability. We have to see more of Biden on the campaign trail. It's non-negotiable at this point. It's clear that this is where he excels. On June 28th, the Biden campaign rally in Raleigh, North Carolina, the day after the debate, proved as much. There, he appeared energetic and coherent. If he needs a receptive audience, he will find that in the battleground states and Democratic strongholds. Either way, we need to see more of him. It's also a moment for the party to embrace Vice President Kamala Harris, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, and other younger politicians who seem to have more favor with the public. The presidency is far from a one-man job, so it wouldn't be a stretch to tout the administration in a way that complements the Biden campaign. I want a plan from the Democrats. I want a way forward with the presidential nominee we have if it is a closed case. I want them to lead, not just react to the sudden influx of bad news. Party leaders need to stop scrambling and get to work. All right, moving on to the Wednesday, July 10th, New York Times. We have an op-ed written by Jake Sullivan titled, "You Can Count on a Strong NATO." Americans understand the value of alliances. They know that these relationships make us stronger and help us build a world that is free, independent, prosperous, and secure. But they also want to make sure that our allies are pulling their weight and paying their fair share of the costs of a common defense. When President Biden took office in 2021, our alliances around the world were atrophied and underutilized. Now, 3.5 years later, our allies are committing more to our common defense than at any point since the end of the Cold War, making both them and America more secure. There is still more progress to be made, but we are well on our way to building strength that advances U.S. interests and enables us to work together to shape the future of the international order. Let's start with the numbers. As NATO meets this week in Washington, we are closer than ever to fulfilling the pledge that alliance members made 10 years ago after Russia's illegitimate annexation of Crimea to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. 23 NATO members out of 32 are expected to meet or exceed that target in 2024, compared with just 9 in 2020 and 5 from 2016. This year alone, America's NATO partners, Canada and 30 European nations, will spend an estimated $506.7 billion on defense. That is an increase of $181 billion from 2020, compared with an increase of $70 billion from 2016 to 2020 during the previous administration. These numbers will continue to improve. In 2023, defense expenditures of NATO nations in Europe and Canada grew by 8%. This year, they are set to grow by 18%. These are not just numbers on a page or a fancy accounting trick. In the next 5 years, our NATO allies will add over 650 fifth-generation F-35 aircraft, over 1,000 air defense systems, nearly 50 warships and submarines, 1,200 battle tanks, 11,300 combat vehicles, and nearly 2,000 artillery systems to modernize their arsenals, making us all more secure. So, indeed, Europe is doing more. There are a number of reasons for this important shift. The president knew that we could persuade our allies and partners to do more and spend more if we strengthened and deepened ties instead of bullying them or threatening to leave the alliance. Europe, as well, was adjusting to the new security realities following Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. The good news is not confined to NATO. In the Indo-Pacific, our closest partners are also increasing their military spending. Japan committed to doubling its national security-related spending, including a 65% increase in military spending by 2027. In 2022, South Korea announced a 5-year plan to spend more than $260 billion on its defense, which would mean annual increases of 6.8% on average. And Australia recently announced that it would spend a record $37 billion on defense next year, with further increases planned over the next few years. Our allies are also spending more on weapons platforms and munitions that are made in America. Combined with our own investments of supplemental funds for Ukraine appropriated by Congress, this funding is being used to revitalize production lines across the country and is putting Americans to work. We are manufacturing weapons that make the United States and the world more secure while strengthening our economy. The strength of the Allied response to Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine has demonstrated why NATO, a 75-year-old alliance, is still critical today. When the United States became aware of Vladimir Putin's plan to invade, President Biden consulted with our allies and built a coalition to support Ukraine. Some were skeptical that Russia would follow through, but when it did, they stood with the Ukrainian people. America's ironclad support for NATO reassured our allies that we would have their back if Russia attacked them. This allowed them to give Ukraine crucial air defenses and munitions that they may have withheld for their own defense had they believed that the alliance was hollow and it was every nation for itself. This is the first time since World War II that our European partners have carried more of the burden than the United States in a major conflict. America has contributed many billions of dollars in military and economic assistance to help Ukraine defend itself. Europe has spent more. According to the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, which tracks overall international support to Ukraine, the United States gave Ukraine $80 billion, or 74 billion euros, between January 2022 and the end of April 2024. Europe gave $110 billion, or 102 billion euros, including long-range missiles, the high-mobility artillery rocket system, armored fighting vehicles, air defense systems, and munitions. The United States is leading a coalition of more than 50 nations around the world, a Euro-Atlantic community, which continues to provide Ukraine all manner of support, from weapons to humanitarian and economic assistance. It's an unprecedented effort. The Biden administration has sought to improve cooperation among our democratic allies globally to harness our collective strength, and the results have been significant. Our Indo-Pacific allies have come to Ukraine's aid, while our European allies are taking a more active role in the Indo-Pacific region. Britain is helping Australia build nuclear-powered submarines. European and Indo-Pacific allies are cooperating closely with the United States to protect sensitive technologies critical to national security from being used by China against us. Partners and allies around the globe are speaking out in support of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and freedom of navigation and rule of law in the South China Sea. More remains to be done. Our allies need to spend more. We must continue our urgent work of strengthening our defense industry and investing in innovation. We must continue to deepen our alliances and strengthen deterrence. We must keep working to integrate Ukraine into the Euro-Atlantic community to help support a long-term foundation for peace and stability in Europe. We expect to make significant progress on all of these tasks this week at the NATO summit. Ultimately, the way to make America more secure and to persuade our allies to do more is to commit our alliances and to work together to counter shared threats and to build a better world. Next up from the New York Times, an op-ed written by Julia Angwin titled, "Your Driving App is Leading You Astray." On my way to Kennedy International Airport, I gripped the wheel tightly, swerving across three lanes of expressway traffic at 50 miles per hour to reach the exit. Minutes later, still shaken from my move, I hear a cheerful, disembodied voice instructing me to re-enter the expressway I had just exited. I curse at my phone. If you use a navigation app, you probably have felt helpless anger when your stupid phone endangers your life and the lives of all the drivers around you to potentially shave a minute or two from your drive time. Or maybe it stuck you on an ugly freeway when a glorious ocean-hugging alternative lies a few miles away. Or maybe it's trapped you on a route with no four-way stops, ignoring a less stressful solution that doesn't leave you worried about a car barreling out of nowhere. For all the discussion of the many extraordinary ways algorithms have changed our society and our lives, one of the most impactful and most infuriating often escapes notice. Dominated by a couple of enormously powerful tech monopolists that have better things to worry about, our leading online mapping systems from Google and Apple are not nearly as good as they could be. You may have heard the extreme stories, such as when navigation apps like Waze and Google Maps apparently steered drivers into lakes and onto impassable dirt roads, or when jurisdictions beg Waze to stop dumping traffic onto their residential streets. But the reality is, these apps affect us, our roads, and our communities every minute of the day. Primarily programmed to find the fastest route, they endanger and infuriate us on a remarkably regular basis. Worse, the promised time savings are often a mirage. There are so many elements included in calculating a route that the estimated time is always a guess. Yet who among us has not seen her estimated arrival time change several times while en route? These products should be calibrated with greater acknowledgement of the uncertainties involved in predicting unexpected slowdowns and road closures. I am firmly of the belief, which I cannot prove as our tech overlords refuse to share data with us, that the algorithms are often optimizing for time savings that are wider than their margin of error. I shouldn't dismiss the fact that digital maps have been transformational and empowering. My father, a mathematician and mapmaker, helped build the first digital maps for early GPS navigation systems. When map apps arrived on my phone, we put away paper maps with a sigh of relief. Now, however, we have all become so reliant on online maps that we have lost the deep knowledge that allows us to make our own calculations of an optimal route. And these maps don't seem to have changed very much since Google bought its competitor Waze. The company now commands an estimated more than 80% of the navigation app market share. It doesn't have to be like this. A navigation app could consider factors such as the safety impact of changing many lanes with little notice. Imagine instructing the app to avoid jumping on and off highways, or to take the scenic route if the added driving time is under 10%. To be clear, this type of customization is possible. Porsche offers it in its navigation app, a choice of routes tailored to your driving style, defined as curvy, fast, or balanced. The open-source project Valhalla offers dozens of ways to optimize routing algorithms, with such options as prioritizing fewer turns or routes with carpool lanes. It would be wonderful if the primary infrastructure that drives our society was built with the right values. It's just not, said Michael Maron, a geographer and longtime contributor to OpenStreetMap, the so-called Wikipedia of maps, which is built by volunteers and whose data provides a base layer for many other maps and navigation apps. On a recent trip to Chicago, I couldn't get my map to offer me the option to take the beautiful Lakeshore Drive on Lake Michigan along my route. It only offered me the Dan Ryan Expressway, a 14-lane Leviathan. The best hope for competition relies on the success of OpenStreetMap. I'm going to have to find that. Its data underpins most maps other than Google, including Amazon, Facebook, and Apple, but it is so under-resourced that it only recently hired paid systems admins to ensure its back-end machines kept running. For a vibrant consumer navigational ecosystem to emerge, society needs to invest in OpenStreetMap as a public good. The giant corporations that rely on its maps should stop freeloading and use some of their hundreds of billions of dollars to support the project. City planners should dedicate staffers to updating their roads and bridges on OpenStreetMap. Communities should submit updates with roads and hazards in their local areas. In addition, we can promote competition by using the few available alternatives. To navigate cities with public transit, try apps such as City Mapper that offer bike, transit, and walking directions, or use the privacy-focused organic maps. And when you have to use a popular driving app, take its directions with a huge grain of salt. Well, that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. I've been reading from the editorial and opinion pages of the Wednesday, July 10th, USA Today and New York Times. I'm Barry Slater. Thanks for listening. So long until next time.